The tale was interrupted by the tears of the audience. Such tears must have flowed in secret, and such compassion would have been criminal under the reign of Phocas, who was peaceably acknowledged in the provinces of the East and West. The images of the emperor and his wife Leontia were exposed in the Lateran to the veneration of the clergy and senate of Rome, and afterwards deposited in the palace of the Caesars, between those of Constantine and Theodosius. As a subject and a Christian, it was the duty of Gregory to acquiesce in the established government. But the joyful applause with which he salutes the fortune of the assassin has sullied with indelible disgrace the character of the saint. The successor of the apostles might have inculcated with decent firmness the guilt of blood and the necessity of repentance. He is content to celebrate the deliverance of the people and the fall of the oppressor, to rejoice that the piety and benignity of Phocas have been raised by providence to the imperial throne, to pray that his hands may be strengthened against all his enemies, and to express a wish, perhaps a prophecy, that after a long and triumphant reign, he may be transferred from a temporal to an everlasting kingdom. I have already traced the steps of a revolution so pleasing in Gregory's opinion, both to heaven and earth, then Phocas does not appear less hateful in the exercise than in the acquisition of power. The pencil of an impartial historian has delineated the portrait of a monster. His diminutive and deformed person, the closeness of his shaggy eyebrows, his red hair, his beardless chin, and his cheek disfigured and discolored by a formidable scar. Ignorant of letters, of laws, and even of arms, he indulged in the supreme rank a more ample privilege of lust and drunkenness, and his brutal pleasures were either injurious to his subjects or disgraceful to himself. Without assuming the office of a prince, he renounced the profession of a soldier, and the reign of Phocas afflicted Europe with ignominious peace and Asia with desolating war. His savage temper was inflamed by passion, hardened by fear, and exasperated by resistance of reproach. The flight of Theodosius to the Persian court had been intercepted by rapid pursuit or a deceitful message. He was beheaded at Nice, and the last hours of the young prince were soothed by the comforts of religion and the consciousness of innocence. Yet his phantom disturbed the repose of the usurper. A whisper was circulated through the East that the son of Maurice was still alive. The people expected their avenger, and the widow and daughters of the late emperor would have adopted as their son and brother the vilest of mankind. In the massacre of the imperial family, the mercy, or rather the discretion, of Phocas had spared these unhappy females, and they were decently confined to a private house. But the spirit of the Empress Constantina, still mindful of her father, her husband, and her sons, aspired to freedom and revenge. At the dead of night she escaped to the sanctuary of Santa Sophia, but her tears and the gold of her associate Germanus were insufficient to provoke an insurrection. Her life was forfeited to revenge, and even to justice, but the patriarch obtained and pledged an oath for her safety. A monastery was allotted for her prison, and the widow of Maurice accepted and abused the lenity of his assassin. The discovery or the suspicion of a second conspiracy dissolved the engagement and rekindled the fury of Phocas. A matron who commanded the respect and pity of mankind, the daughter, wife, and mother of emperors, was tortured like the vilest malefactor to force a confession of her designs and associates. And the Empress Constantina, with her three innocent daughters, was beheaded at Chalcedon on the same ground which had been stained with the blood of her husband and five sons. After such an example, it would be superfluous to enumerate the names and sufferings of meaner victims. Their condemnation was seldom preceded by the forms of trial, and their punishment was embittered by the refinements of cruelty. Their eyes were pierced, their tongues were torn from the root, the hands and feet were amputated. Some expired under the lash, others in the flames. Others again were transfixed with arrows. and a simple, speedy death was mercy which they could rarely obtain. The Hippodrome, the sacred asylum of the pleasures and the liberty of the Romans, was polluted with heads and limbs and mangled bodies. And the companions of Phocas were the most sensible that neither his favour nor their services could protect them from a tyrant, the worthy rival of the Caligulas and Domitians of the first age of the empire. Part 3. A daughter of Phocas, his only child, was given in marriage to the patrician Crispus, and the royal images of the bride and bridegroom were indiscreetly placed in the circus by the side of the emperor. The father must desire that his posterity should inherit the fruit of his crimes, but the monarch was offended by this premature and popular association. The tribunes of the Green faction, who accused the officious error of their sculptors, were condemned to instant death. Their lives were granted to the prayers of the people. But Crispus might reasonably doubt whether a jealous usurper could forget and pardon his involuntary competition. The Green faction was alienated by the ingratitude of Phocas and the loss of their privileges. Every province of the empire was ripe for rebellion, and Heraclius, exarch of Africa, persisted above 2 years in refusing all tribute and obedience to the centurion who disgraced the throne of Constantinople. By the secret emissaries of Crispus and the Senate, the independent exarch was solicited to save and to govern his country. But his ambition was chilled by age, and he resigned the dangerous enterprise to his son Heraclius and to Nicetas, the son of Gregory, his friend and lieutenant. The powers of Africa were armed by the two adventurous youths. They agreed that the one should navigate the fleet from Carthage to Constantinople, that the other should lead an army through Egypt and Asia, and that the imperial purple should be the reward of diligence and success. A faint rumor of their undertaking was conveyed to the ears of Phocas, and the wife and mother of the younger Heraclius were secured as the hostages of his faith. But the treacherous heart of Crispus extenuated the distant peril. The means of defense were neglected or delayed, and the tyrant supinely slept till the African navy cast anchor in the Hellespont. Their standard was joined at Abydos by the fugitives and exiles who thirsted for revenge. The ships of Heraclius, whose lofty masts were adorned with the holy symbols of religion, steered their triumphant course through the Propontis, and Phocas beheld from the windows of the palace his approaching and inevitable fate. The Green faction was tempted, by gifts and promises, to oppose a feeble and fruitless resistance to the landing of the Africans. But the people, and even the guards, were determined by the well-timed defection of Crispus, and the tyrant was seized by a private enemy who boldly invaded the solitude of the palace. Stripped of the diadem and purple, clothed in a vile habit, and loaded with chains, he was transported in a small boat to the imperial galley of Heraclius, who reproached him with the crimes of his abominable reign. "Wilt thou govern better?" were the last words of the despair of Phocas. After suffering each variety of insult and torture, his head was severed from his body, the mangled trunk was cast into the flames, and the same treatment was inflicted on the statues of the vain usurper and the seditious banner of the Green faction. The voice of the clergy, the Senate, and the people invited Heraclius to ascend the throne which he had purified from guilt and ignominy. After some graceful hesitation, he yielded to their entreaties. His coronation was accompanied by that of his wife Eudoxia, and their posterity, till the fourth generation, continued to reign over the empire of the East. The voyage of Heraclius had been easy and prosperous. The tedious march of Nicetas was not accomplished before the decision of the contest, but he submitted without a murmur to the fortune of his friend, and his laudable intentions were rewarded with an equestrian statue and a daughter of the emperor. It was more difficult to trust the fidelity of Crispus, whose recent services were recompensed by the command of the Cappadocian army. His arrogance soon provoked and seemed to excuse the ingratitude of his new sovereign. In the presence of the Senate, the son-in-law of Phocas was condemned to embrace the monastic life, and the sentence was justified by the weighty observation of Heraclius that the man who had betrayed his father could never be faithful to his friend. Even after his death, the Republic was afflicted by the crimes of Phocas, which, armed with a pious cause, the most formidable of her enemies. According to the friendly and equal forms of the Byzantine and Persian courts, he announced his exaltation to the throne, and his ambassador, Lilius, who had presented him with the heads of Maurice and his sons, was the best qualified to describe the circumstances of the tragic scene. However it might be varnished by fiction or sophistry, Chosroes turned with horror from the assassin, imprisoned the pretended envoy, disclaimed the usurper, and declared himself the avenger of his father and benefactor. The sentiments of grief and resentment which humanity would feel and honor would dictate promoted on this occasion the interest of the Persian king, and his interest was powerfully magnified by the national and religious prejudices of the Magi and satraps. In a strain of artful adulation which assumed the language of freedom, they presumed to censure the excess of his gratitude and friendship for the Greeks, a nation with whom it was dangerous to conclude either peace or alliance, whose superstition was devoid of truth and justice, and who must be incapable of any virtue, since they could perpetrate the most atrocious of crimes, the impious murder of their sovereign. For the crime of an ambitious centurion, the nation which he oppressed was chastised with the calamities of war, and the same calamities, at the end of 20 years, was retaliated and redoubled on the heads of the Persians. The general who had restored Chosroes to the throne still commanded in the east, and the name of Narses was the formidable sound with which the Assyrian mothers were accustomed to terrify their infants. It is not improbable that a native subject of Persia should encourage his master and his friend to deliver and possess the provinces of Asia. It is still more probable that Chosroes should animate his troops by the assurance that the sword which they dreaded the most would remain in its scabbard, or be drawn in their favor. The hero could not depend on the faith of a tyrant, and the tyrant was conscious how little he deserved the obedience of a hero. Narses was removed from his military command. He reared an independent standard at Hierapolis in Syria. He was betrayed by fallacious promises and burnt alive in the marketplace of Constantinople. Deprived of the only chief whom they could fear or esteem, the bands which he had led to victory were twice broken by the cavalry, trampled by the elephants, and pierced by the arrows of the barbarians. And a great number of the captives were beheaded on the field of battle by the sentence of the victor, who might justly condemn these seditious mercenaries as the authors or accomplices of the death of Maurice. Under the reign of Phocas, the fortifications of Medin, Dara, Amida, and Edessa were successively besieged, reduced, and destroyed by the Persian monarch. He passed the Euphrates, occupied the Syrian cities Hierapolis, Chalcis, and Berea, or Aleppo, and soon encompassed the walls of Antioch with his irresistible arms. The rapid tide of success discloses the decay of the empire, the incapacity of Phocas, and the disaffection of his subjects. And Chosroes provided a decent apology for their submission or revolt by an impostor who attended his camp as the son of Maurice and the lawful heir of the monarchy. The first intelligence from the east which Heraclius received was that of the loss of Antioch. But the aged metropolis, so often overturned by earthquakes and pillaged by the enemy, could supply but a small and languid stream of treasure and blood. The Persians were equally successful and more fortunate in the sack of Caesarea, the capital of Cappadocia, and as they advanced beyond the ramparts of the frontier, the boundary of ancient war, they found a less obstinate resistance and a more plentiful harvest. The pleasant vale of Damascus has been adorned in every age with a royal city. Her obscure felicity has hitherto escaped the historian of the Roman Empire. But Chosroes reposed his troops in the paradise of Damascus before he ascended the hills of Libanus or invaded the cities of the Phoenician coast. The conquest of Jerusalem, which had been meditated by Nushirvan, was achieved by the zeal and avarice of his grandson. The ruin of the proudest monument of Christianity was vehemently urged by the intolerant spirit of the Magi, and he could enlist for this holy warfare with an army of 26,000 Jews, whose furious bigotry might compensate in some degree for the want of valor and discipline. After the reduction of Galilee and the region beyond the Jordan, whose resistance appears to have delayed the fate of the capital, Jerusalem itself was taken by assault. The sepulchre of Christ and the stately churches of Helena and Constantine were consumed, or at least damaged, by the flames. The devout offerings of 300 years were rifled in one sacrilegious day. The patriarch Zechariah and the true cross were transported into Persia, and the massacre of 90,000 Christians is imputed to the Jews and Arabs, who swelled the disorder of the Persian march. The fugitives of Palestine were entertained at Alexandria by the charity of John the Archbishop, who is distinguished among a crowd of saints by the epithet of almsgiver. And the revenues of the church, with a treasure of £300,000, were restored to the true proprietors, the poor of every country and every denomination. But Egypt itself, the only province which had been exempt since the time of Diocletian from foreign and domestic war, was again subdued by the successors of Cyrus. Pelusium, the key of that impervious country, was surprised by the cavalry of the Persians. They passed with impunity the innumerable channels of the delta and explored the long valley of the Nile, from the pyramids of Memphis to the confines of Ethiopia. Alexandria might have been relieved by a naval force, but the archbishop and the prefect embarked for Cyprus, and Chosroes entered the second city of the empire, which still preserved a wealthy remnant of industry and commerce. His western trophy was erected not on the walls of Carthage, but in the neighborhood of Tripoli. The Greek colonies of Cyrene were finally extirpated, and the conqueror, treading in the footsteps of Alexander, returned in triumph through the sands of the Libyan desert. In the same campaign, another army advanced from the Euphrates to the Thracian Bosphorus. Chalcedon surrendered after a long siege, and a Persian camp was maintained above 10 years in the presence of Constantinople. The seacoast of Pontus, the city of Ancyra, and the Isle of Rhodes are enumerated among the last conquests of the great king. And if Chosroes had possessed any maritime power, his boundless ambition would have spread slavery and desolation over the provinces of Europe. From the long-disputed banks of the Tigris and Euphrates, the reign of the grandson of Nushirvan was suddenly extended to the Hellespont and the Nile, the ancient limits of the Persian monarchy. But the provinces, which had been fashioned by the habits of 600 years to the virtues and vices of the Roman government, supported with reluctance the yoke of the barbarians. The idea of a republic was kept alive by the institutions, or at least by the writings, of the Greeks and Romans, and the subjects of Heraclius had been educated to pronounce the words of liberty and law. But it has always been the pride and policy of Oriental princes to display the titles and attributes of their omnipotence, to upbraid a nation of slaves with their true name and abject condition, and to enforce by cruel and insolent threats the rigor of their absolute commands. The Christians of the East were scandalized by the worship of fire and the impious doctrine of the two principles. The Magi were not less intolerant than the bishops, and the martyrdom of some native Persians who had deserted the religion of Zoroaster was conceived to be the prelude of a fierce and general persecution. By the oppressive laws of Justinian, the adversaries of the church were made the enemies of the state. The alliance of the Jews, Nestorians, and Jacobites had contributed to the success of Chosroes, and his partial favor to the sectaries provoked the hatred and fears of the Catholic clergy. Conscious of their fear and hatred, the Persian conqueror governed his new subjects with an iron scepter, and, as if he suspected the stability of his dominion, he exhausted their wealth by exorbitant tributes, and licentious rapine despoiled or demolished the temples of the East, and transported to his hereditary realms the gold, the silver, the precious marbles, the arts, and the artists of the Asiatic cities. In the obscure picture of the calamities of the empire, it is not easy to discern the figure of Chosroes himself, to separate his actions from those of his lieutenants, or to ascertain his personal merit in the general blaze of glory and magnificence. He enjoyed with ostentation the fruits of victory, and frequently retired from the hardships of war to the luxury of the palace. But in the space of 24 years, he was deterred by superstition or resentment from approaching the gates of Ctesiphon, and his favorite residence of Artemita, or Dastagerd, was situated beyond the Tigris, about 60 miles to the north of the capital. The adjacent pastures were covered with flocks and herds. The paradise or park was replenished with pheasants, peacocks, ostriches, roebucks, and wild boars, and the noble game of lions and tigers was sometimes turned loose for the bolder pleasures of the chase. 960 elephants were maintained for the use or splendor of the great king. His tents and baggage were carried into the field by 12,000 great camels and 8,000 of a smaller size, and the royal stables were filled with 6,000 mules and horses, among whom the names of Shebdiz and Barid are renowned for their speed or beauty. 6,000 guards successively mounted before the palace gate. The service of the interior apartments was performed by 12,000 slaves, and in the number of 3,000 virgins, the fairest of Asia, some happy concubine might console her master for the age or the indifference of Sirrah. The various treasures of gold, silver, gems, silks, and aromatics were deposited in 100 subterraneous vaults, and the chamber, Badaverd, denoted the accidental gift of the winds which had wafted the spoils of Heraclius into one of the Syrian harbors of his rival. The vice of flattery, and perhaps of fiction, is not ashamed to compute the 30,000 rich hangings that adorn the walls, the 40,000 columns of silver, or more probably of marble, and plated wood that supported the roof, and 1,000 globes of gold suspended in the dome to imitate the motions of the planets and the constellations of the zodiac. While the Persian monarch contemplated the wonders of his art and power, he received an epistle from an obscure citizen of Mecca, inviting him to acknowledge Muhammad as the apostle of God. He rejected the invitation and tore the epistle. "It is thus," exclaimed the Arabian prophet, "that God will tear the kingdom and reject the supplications of Chosroes." Placed on the verge of the two great empires of the East, Muhammad observed with secret joy the progress of their mutual destruction, and in the midst of the Persian triumphs, he ventured to foretell that before many years should elapse, victory should again return to the banners of the Romans. At the time when this prediction is said to have been delivered, no prophecy could be more distant from its accomplishment since the first 12 years of Heraclius announced the approaching dissolution of the empire. If the motives of Chosroes had been pure and honorable, he must have ended the quarrel with the death of Phocas, and he would have embraced as his best ally the fortunate African who had so generously avenged the injuries of his benefactor Maurice. The prosecution of the war revealed the true character of the barbarian, and the suppliant embassies of Heraclius to beseech his clemency that he would spare the innocent, accept a tribute, and give peace to the world, were rejected with contemptuous silence or insolent menace. Syria, Egypt, and the provinces of Asia were subdued by the Persian arms, while Europe, from the confines of Istria to the long wall of Thrace, was oppressed by the Avars, unsatiated with the blood and rapine of the Italian war. They had coolly massacred their male captives in the sacred field of Pannonia. The women and children were reduced to servitude, and the noblest virgins were abandoned to the promiscuous lust of the barbarians. The amorous matron who opened the gates of Friuli passed a short night in the arms of her royal lover. The next evening, Romilda was condemned to the embraces of 12 Avars. And the third day the Lombard princess was impaled in the sight of the camp, while the Chagan observed with a cruel smile that such a husband was the fit recompense of her lewdness and perfidy. By these implacable enemies, Heraclius, on either side, was insulted and besieged, and the Roman Empire was reduced to the walls of Constantinople with the remnant of Greece, Italy, and Africa, and some maritime cities from Tyre to Trebizond of the Asiatic coast. After the loss of Egypt, the capital was afflicted by famine and pestilence, and the emperor, incapable of resistance and hopeless of relief, had resolved to transfer his person and government to the more secure residence of Carthage. His ships were already laden with the treasures of the palace. But his flight was arrested by the patriarch, who armed the powers of religion in the defense of his country, led Heraclius to the altar of Santa Sophia, and extorted a solemn oath that he would live and die with the people whom God had entrusted to his care. The Chagan was encamped in the plains of Thrace, but he dissembled his perfidious designs and solicited an interview with the emperor near the town of Heraclea. Their reconciliation was celebrated with equestrian games. The Senate and people, in their gayest apparel, resorted to the festival of peace, and the Avars beheld with envy and desire the spectacle of Roman luxury. On a sudden the hippodrome was encompassed by the Scythian cavalry, who had pressed their secret and nocturnal march. The tremendous sound of the Chagan's whip gave the signal of the assault, and Heraclius, wrapping his diadem round his arm, was saved with extreme hazard by the fleetness of his horse. So rapid was the pursuit that the Avars almost entered the Golden Gate of Constantinople with the flying crowds. But the plunder of the suburbs rewarded their treason, and they transported, beyond the Danube, 270,000 captives. On the shore of Chalcedon, the emperor held a safer conference with a more honorable foe, who, before Heraclius descended from his galley, saluted with reverence and pity the majesty of the purple. The friendly offer of Syene, the Persian general, to conduct an embassy to the presence of the great king, was accepted with the warmest gratitude, and the prayer for pardon and peace was humbly presented by the Praetorian prefect, the prefect of the city, and one of the first ecclesiastics of the patriarchal church. But the lieutenant of Chosroes had fatally mistaken the intentions of his master. "It was not an embassy," said the tyrant of Asia. "It was the person of Heraclius, bound in chains, that he should have brought to the foot of my throne. I will never give peace to the emperor of Rome till he had abjured his crucified god and embraced the worship of the sun." Syene was flayed alive, according to the inhuman practice of his country, and the separate and rigorous confinement of the ambassadors violated the law of nations and the faith of an express stipulation. Yet the experience of 6 years at length persuaded the Persian monarch to renounce the conquest of Constantinople and to specify the annual tribute or ransom of the Roman Empire. 1,000 talents of gold, 1,000 talents of silver, 1,000 silk robes, 1,000 horses, and 1,000 virgins. Heraclius subscribed these ignominious terms, but the time and space which he obtained to collect such treasures from the poverty of the East was industriously employed in the preparations of a bold and desperate attack. Of the characters conspicuous in history, that of Heraclius is one of the most extraordinary and inconsistent. In the first and last years of a long reign, the emperor appears to be the slave of sloth, of pleasure, or of superstition, the careless and impotent spectator of the public calamities. But the languid mists of the morning and evening are separated by the brightness of the meridian sun. The Arcadius of the palace arose the Caesar of the camp, and the honor of Rome and Heraclius was gloriously retrieved by the exploits and trophies of 6 adventurous campaigns. It was the duty of the Byzantine historians to have revealed the causes of his slumber and vigilance, At this distance we can only conjecture that he was endowed with more personal courage than political resolution, and that he was detained by the charms and perhaps the arts of his niece Martina, with whom, after the death of Eudokia, he contracted an incestuous marriage, and that he yielded to the base advice of the counsellors, who urged, as a fundamental law, that the life of the emperor should never be exposed in the field. Perhaps he was awakened by the last insolent demand of the Persian conqueror. But at the moment when Heraclius assumed the spirit of a hero, the only hopes of the Romans were drawn from the vicissitudes of fortune, which might threaten the proud prosperity of Chosroes, and must be favourable to those who had attained the lowest period of depression. To provide for the expenses of war was the first care of the emperor. Then, for the purpose of collecting the tribute, he was allowed to solicit the benevolence of the eastern provinces. But the revenue no longer flowed in the usual channels. The credit of an arbitrary prince is annihilated by his power, and the courage of Heraclius was first displayed in daring to borrow the consecrated wealth of churches under the solemn vow of restoring, with usury, whatever he had been compelled to employ in the service of religion and the empire. The clergy themselves appear to have sympathized with the public distress, and the secret patriarch of Alexandria, without admitting the precedent of sacrilege, assisted his sovereign by the miraculous or seasonable revelation of a secret treasure. Of the soldiers who had conspired with Phocas, only two were found to have survived this stroke of time and of the barbarians. The loss, even of these seditious veterans, was imperfectly supplied by the new levies of Heraclius, and the gold of the sanctuary united in the same camp the names and arms and languages of the East and West. He would have been content with the neutrality of the Avars, and his friendly entreaty that the Chagan would act not as the enemy, but as the guardian of the empire, was accompanied with a more persuasive donative of 200,000 pieces of gold. 2 days after the festival of Easter, the emperor, exchanging his purple for the simple garb of a penitent and warrior, gave the signal of his departure. To the faith of the people, Heraclius recommended his children. The civil and military powers were vested in the most deserving hands, and the discretion of the patriarch and senate was authorized to save or surrender the city if they should be oppressed in his absence by the superior forces of the enemy. The neighboring heights of Chalcedon were covered with tents and arms, but if the new levies of Heraclius had been rashly led to the attack, the victory of the Persians in the site of Constantinople might have been the last day of the Roman Empire. As imprudent would it have been to advance into the provinces of Asia, leaving their innumerable cavalry to intercept his convoys, and continually to hang on the lassitude and disorder of his rear. But the Greeks were still masters of the sea. A fleet of galleys, transports, and storeships was assembled in the harbour. The barbarians consented to embark. A steady wind carried them through the Hellespont. The western and southern coast of Asia Minor lay on their left hand. The spirit of their chief was first displayed in a storm, and even the eunuchs of his train were excited to suffer and to work by the example of their master. He landed his troops on the confines of Syria and Cilicia, in the Gulf of Scandarun, where the coast suddenly turns to the south, and his discernment was expressed in the choice of this important post. From all sides the scattered garrisons of the maritime cities and the mountains might repair with speed and safety to his imperial standard. The natural fortifications of Cilicia protected and even concealed the camp of Heraclius, which was pitched near Issus, on the same ground where Alexander had vanquished the host of Darius. The angle which the emperor occupied was deeply indented into a vast semicircle of the Asiatic, Armenian, and Syrian provinces. And to whatsoever point of the circumference he should direct his attack, it was easy for him to dissemble his own motions and to prevent those of the enemy. In the camp of Issus, the Roman general reformed the sloth and disorder of the veterans and educated the new recruits in the knowledge and practice of military virtue. Unfolding the miraculous image of Christ, He urged them to revenge the holy altars which had been profaned by the worshippers of fire. Addressing them by the endearing appellations of sons and brethren, he deplored the public and private wrongs of the Republic. The subjects of a monarch were persuaded that they fought in the cause of freedom, and a similar enthusiasm was communicated to the foreign mercenaries, who must have viewed with equal indifference the interest of Rome and of Persia. Heraclius himself, with the skill and patience of a centurion, inculcated the lessons of the school of tactics, and the soldiers were assiduously trained in the use of their weapons and the exercises and evolutions of the field. The cavalry and infantry in light or heavy armor were divided into two parties. The trumpets were fixed in the center, and their signals directed the march, the charge, the retreat or pursuit, the direct or oblique order, the deep or extended phalanx, to represent in fictitious combat the operations of genuine war. Whatever hardships the emperor imposed on the troops, he inflicted with equal severity on himself. Their labor, their diet, their sleep were measured by the inflexible rules of discipline, and without despising the enemy, they were taught to repose an implicit confidence in their own valor and the wisdom of their leader. Cilicia was soon encompassed with the Persian arms, but their cavalry hesitated to enter the defiles of Mount Taurus till they were circumvented by the evolutions of Heraclius, who insensibly gained their rear, whilst he appeared to present his front in order of battle. By false motion, which seemed to threaten Armenia, he drew them, against their wishes, to a general action. They were tempted by the artful disorder of his camp, but when they advanced to combat, the ground, the sun, and the expectation of both armies were unpropitious to the barbarians. The Romans successfully repeated their tactics in a field of battle, and the event of the day declared to the world that the Persians were not invincible, and that a hero was invested with the purple. Strong in victory and fame, Heraclius boldly ascended the heights of Mount Taurus, directed his march through the plains of Cappadocia, and established his troops for the winter season in safe and plentiful quarters on the banks of the river Halys. His soul was superior to the vanity of entertaining Constantinople with an imperfect triumph, but the presence of the emperor was indispensably required to soothe the restless and rapacious spirit of the Avars. Since the days of Scipio and Hannibal, no bolder enterprise has been attempted than that which Heraclius achieved for the deliverance of the empire. He permitted the Persians to oppress for a while the provinces and to insult with impunity the capital of the East, while the Roman emperor explored his perilous way through the Black Sea and the mountains of Armenia, penetrated into the heart of Persia, and recalled the armies of the great king to the defense of their bleeding country. With a select band of 5,000 soldiers, Heraclius sailed from Constantinople to Trebizond, assembled his forces which had wintered in the Pontic regions, and from the mouth of the Phasis to the Caspian Sea, encouraged his subjects and allies to march with the successor of Constantine under the faithful and victorious banner of the cross. When the legions of Lucullus and Pompey first passed the Euphrates, they blushed at their easy victory over the natives of Armenia. But the long experience of war had hardened the minds and bodies of that effeminate people. Their zeal and bravery were approved in the service of a declining empire. They abhorred and feared the usurpation of the house of Sasan, and the memory of persecution envenomed their pious hatred of the enemies of Christ. The limits of Armenia, as it had been ceded to the Emperor Maurice, extended as far as the Araxes. The river submitted to the indignity of a bridge, and Heraclius, in the footsteps of Mark Antony, advanced towards the city of Taurus, or Gandzaka, the ancient and modern capital of one of the provinces of Media. At the head of 40,000 men, Chosroes himself had returned from some distant expedition to oppose the progress of the Roman arms. But he retreated on the approach of Heraclius, declining the generous alternative of peace or of battle. Instead of 500,000 of inhabitants, which have been ascribed to Taurus under the reign of the Sophies, the city contained no more than 3,000 houses. But the value of the royal treasures was enhanced by a tradition that they were the spoils of Croesus, which had been transported by Cyrus from the citadel of Sardis. The rapid conquests of Heraclius were suspended only by the winter season. A motive of prudence or superstition determined his retreat into the province of Albania along the shores of the Caspian, and his tents were most probably pitched in the plains of Mogan, the favorite encampment of Oriental princes. In the course of this successful inroad, he signalized the zeal and revenge of a Christian emperor. At his command, the soldiers extinguished the fire and destroyed the temples of the Magi. The statues of Chosroes, who aspired to divine honors, were abandoned to the flames, and the ruins of Thebama, or Ormia, which had given birth to Zoroaster himself, made some atonement for the injuries of the Holy Sepulchre. A purer spirit of religion was shown in the relief and deliverance of 50,000 captives. Heraclius was rewarded by their tears and grateful acclamations. But this wise measure, which spread the fame of his benevolence, diffused the murmurs of the Persians against the pride and obstinacy of their own sovereign. Part 4. Amidst the glories of the succeeding campaign, Heraclius is almost lost to our eyes and to those of the Byzantine historians. From the spacious and fruitful plains of Albania, the emperor appears to follow the chain of Hyrcanian mountains to descend into the province of Media, or Iraq, and to carry his victorious arms as far as the royal cities of Kasbin and Ispahan, which had never been approached by a Roman conqueror. Alarmed by the danger of his kingdom, the powers of Chosroes were already recalled from the Nile and the Bosphorus, and three formidable armies surrounded, in a distant and hostile land, the camp of the emperor. The Colchian allies prepared to desert his standard, and the fears of the bravest veterans were expressed, rather than concealed, by their desponding silence. "Be not terrified," said the intrepid Heraclius, "by the multitudes of your foes. With the aid of heaven, one Roman may triumph over 1,000 barbarians. But if we devote our lives for the salvation of our brethren, we shall obtain the crown of martyrdom, and our immortal reward will be liberally paid by God and posterity." These magnanimous sentiments were supported by the vigor of his actions. He repelled the threefold attack of the Persians, improved the divisions of their chiefs, and by a well-concerted train of marches, retreats, and successful actions, finally chased them from the field into the fortified cities of Media and Assyria. In the severity of the winter season, Sabaraza deemed himself secure in the walls of Salban. He was surprised by the activity of Heraclius, who divided his troops and performed a laborious march in the silence of the night. The flat roofs of the houses were defended with useless valor against the darts and torches of the Romans. The satraps and nobles of Persia, with their wives and children and the flower of their martial youth, were either slain or made prisoners. The general escaped by a precipitate flight, but his golden armor was the prize of the conqueror, and the soldiers of Heraclius enjoyed the wealth and repose which they had so nobly deserved. On the return of spring, the emperor traversed in 7 days the mountains of Kurdistan, and passed without resistance the rapid stream of the Tigris. Oppressed by the weight of their spoils and captives, the Roman army halted under the walls of Amida, and Heraclius informed the Senate of Constantinople of his safety and success, which they had already felt by the retreat of the besiegers. The bridges of the Euphrates were destroyed by the Persians, but as soon as the emperor had discovered a ford, they hastily retired to defend the banks of the Sarus in Cilicia. That river, an impetuous torrent, was about 300 feet broad. The bridge was fortified with strong turrets, and the banks were lined with barbarian archers. After a bloody conflict which continued till the evening, the Romans prevailed in the assault, and a Persian of gigantic size was slain and thrown into the Sorus by the hand of the emperor himself. The enemies were dispersed and dismayed. Heraclius pursued his march to Sebaste in Cappadocia, and at the expiration of 3 years, the same coast of the Black Sea applauded his return from a long and victorious expedition. Instead of skirmishing on the frontier, the two monarchs who disputed the empire of the East aimed their desperate strokes at the heart of their rival. The military force of Persia was wasted by the marches and combats of 20 years, and many of the veterans who had survived the perils of the sword and the climate were still detained in the fortresses of Egypt and Syria. But the revenge and ambition of Chosroes exhausted his kingdom, and the new levies of subjects, strangers, and slaves were divided into 3 formidable bodies. The first army of 50,000 men, illustrious by the ornament and title of the Golden Spears, was destined to march against Heraclius. The second was stationed to prevent his junction with the troops of his brother Theodore's, and the third was commanded to besiege Constantinople and to second the operations of the Chagan, with whom the Persian king had ratified a treaty of alliance and partition. Serbar, the general of the third army, penetrated through the provinces of Asia to the well-known camp of Chalcedon, and amused himself with the destruction of the sacred and profane buildings of the Asiatic suburbs, while he impatiently waited the arrival of his Scythian friends on the opposite side of the Bosphorus. On the 29th of June, 30,000 barbarians, the vanguard of the Avars, forced the long wall and drove into the capital a promiscuous crowd of peasants, citizens, and soldiers. 40,000 of his native subjects, and of the vassal tribes of Gepidi, Russians, Bulgarians, and Sclavonians, advanced under the standard of the Chagan. A month was spent in marches and negotiations, but the whole city was invested on the 31st of July, from the suburbs of Pera and Galata to the Blakerni and Seven Towers. And the inhabitants descried with terror the flaming signals of the European and Asiatic shores. In the meanwhile, the magistrates of Constantinople repeatedly strove to purchase the retreat of the Chagan, but their deputies were rejected and insulted, and he suffered the patricians to stand before his throne, while the Persian envoys, in silk robes, were seated by his side. "You see," said the haughty barbarian, "the proofs of my perfect union with the great king, and his lieutenant is ready to send into my camp a select band of 3,000 warriors. Presume no longer to tempt your master with a partial and inadequate ransom. Your wealth and your city are the only presents worthy of my acceptance. For yourselves I shall permit you to depart, each with an undergarment and a shirt. And, at my entreaty, my friend Sabar will not refuse a passage through his lines. Your absent prince, even now a captive or a fugitive, has left Constantinople to its fate, nor can you escape the arms of the Avars and Persians, unless you could soar into the air like birds, unless, like fishes, you could dive into the waves." During 10 successive days, the capital was assaulted by the Avars, who had made some progress in the science of attack. They advanced to sap or batter the wall under the cover of the impenetrable tortoise. Their engines discharged a perpetual volley of stones and darts, and 12 lofty towers of wood exalted the combatants to the height of the neighboring ramparts. But the Senate and people were animated by the spirit of Heraclius, who had detached to their relief a body of 12,000 cuirassiers. The powers of fire and mechanics were used with superior art and success in the defense of Constantinople, and the galleys, with 2 and 3 ranks of oars, commanded the Bosphorus and rendered the Persians the idle spectators of the defeat of their allies. The Avars were repulsed. A fleet of Sclavonian canoes was destroyed in the harbor. The vassals of the Chagan threatened to desert. His provisions were exhausted, and after burning his engines, he gave the signal of a slow and formidable retreat. The devotion of the Romans ascribed this signal deliverance to the Virgin Mary, but the Mother of Christ would surely have condemned their inhuman murder of the Persian envoys, who were entitled to the rights of humanity, if they were not protected by the laws of nations. After the division of his army, Heraclius prudently retired to the banks of the Phasis, from whence he maintained a defensive war against the 50,000 gold spears of Persia. His anxiety was relieved by the deliverance of Constantinople. His hopes were confirmed by a victory of his brother Theodorus, and to the hostile league of Chosroes with the Avars, the Roman emperor opposed the useful and honourable alliance of the Turks. At his liberal invitation, the horde of Khazars transported their tents from the plains of the Volga to the mountains of Georgia. Heraclius received them in the neighbourhood of Tiflis, and the Khan, with his nobles, dismounted from their horses, if we may credit the Greeks, and fell prostrate on the ground to adore the purple of the Caesars. Such voluntary homage and important aid were entitled to the warmest acknowledgments, and the emperor, taking off his own diadem, placed it on the head of the Turkish prince, whom he saluted with a tender embrace and the appellation of son. After a sumptuous banquet, he presented Zebel with the plate and ornaments, the gold, the gems, and the silk which had been used at the imperial table, and with his own hand distributed rich jewels and earrings to his new allies. In a secret interview, he produced the portrait of his daughter Eudokia, condescended to flatter the barbarian with the promise of a fair and august bride, obtained an immediate succour of 40,000 horse, and negotiated a strong diversion of the Turkish arms on the side of the Oxus. The Persians, in their turn, retreated with precipitation. In the camp of Edessa, Heraclius reviewed an army of 70,000 Romans and strangers, and some months were successfully employed in the recovery of the cities of Syria, Mesopotamia, and Armenia, whose fortifications had been imperfectly restored. Sabah still maintained the important station of Chalcedon, but the jealousy of Chosroes, or the artifice of Heraclius, soon alienated the mind of that powerful satrap from the service of his king and country. A messenger was intercepted with a real or fictitious mandate to the Kadaragan, or second-in-command, directing him to send without delay to the throne the head of a guilty or unfortunate general. The dispatches were transmitted to Sabah himself, and as soon as he read the sentence of his own death, he dexterously inserted the names of 400 officers, assembled a military council, and asked the Kadaragan whether he was prepared to execute the commands of their tyrant. The Persians unanimously declared that Chosroes had forfeited the scepter. A separate treaty was concluded with the government of Constantinople, and if some considerations of honour or policy restrained Sabah from joining the standard of Heraclius, the emperor was assured that he might prosecute without interruption his designs of victory and peace. Deprived of his firmest support and doubtful of the fidelity of his subjects, the greatness of Chosroes was still conspicuous in its ruins. The number of 500,000 may be interpreted as an Oriental metaphor to describe the men and arms, the horses and elephants that covered Media and Assyria against the invasion of Heraclius. Yet the Romans boldly advanced from the Araxes to the Tigris, and the timid prudence of Rhazates was content to follow them by forced marches through a desolate country, till he received a peremptory mandate to risk the fate of Persia in a decisive battle. Eastward of the Tigris, at the end of the bridge of Mosul, the great Nineveh had formerly been erected. The city, and even the ruins of the city, had long since disappeared. The vacant space afforded a spacious field for the operations of the two armies. But these operations are neglected by the Byzantine historians, and, like the authors of epic poetry and romance, they ascribe the victory not to the military conduct, but to the personal valour of their favourite hero. On this memorable day, Heraclius, on his horse Pallas, surpassed the bravest of his warriors. His lip was pierced with a spear. The steed was wounded in the thigh. But he carried his master safe and victorious through the triple phalanx of the barbarians. In the heat of the action, three valiant chiefs were successively slain by the sword and lance of the emperor. Among these was Rhazates himself. He fell like a soldier, but the sight of his head scattered grief and despair through the fainting ranks of the Persians. His armor of pure and massy gold, the shield of 120 plates, the sword and belt, the saddle and cuirass, adorned the triumph of Heraclius. And if he had not been faithful to Christ and his mother, the champion of Rome might have offered the fourth opim spoils to the Jupiter of the capital. In the battle of Nineveh, which was fiercely fought from daybreak to the 11th hour, 28 standards, besides those which might be broken or torn, were taken from the Persians. The greatest part of their army was cut in pieces, and the victors, concealing their own loss, passed the night on the field. They acknowledged that on this occasion it was less difficult to kill than to discomfit the soldiers of Chosroes. Amidst the bodies of their friends, no more than two bow shots from the enemy, the remnant of the Persian cavalry stood firm till the 7th hour of the night. About the 8th hour they retired to their unrifled camp, collected their baggage, and dispersed on all sides, from the want of orders rather than of resolution. The diligence of Heraclius was not less admirable in the use of victory. By a march of 48 miles in 24 hours, his vanguard occupied the bridges of the great and the lesser Zab, and the cities and palaces of Assyria were open for the first time to the Romans. By a just gradation of magnificent scenes, they penetrated to the royal seat of Dustagert, and though much of the treasure had been removed, and much had been expended, the remaining wealth appears to have exceeded their hopes, and even to have satiated their avarice. Whatever could not be easily transported they consumed with fire, that Chosroes might feel the anguish of those wounds which he had so often inflicted on the provinces of the empire. And justice might allow the excuse, if the desolation had been confined to the works of regal luxury, if national hatred, military license, and religious zeal had not wasted with equal rage the habitations and the temples of the guiltless subject. The recovery of 300 Roman standards and the deliverance of the numerous captives of Edessa and Alexandria reflect a purer glory on the arms of Heraclius. From the palace of Dastagerd he pursued his march within a few miles of Modane, or Ctesiphon, till he was stopped on the banks of the Arba by the difficulty of the passage, the rigor of the season, and perhaps the fame of an impregnable capital. The return of the emperor is marked by the modern name of the city of Shertzur. He fortunately passed Mount Zara before the snow, which fell incessantly 34 days, and the citizens of Ganska or Tauris were compelled to entertain the soldiers and their horses with a hospitable reception. When the ambition of Chosroes was reduced to the defense of his hereditary kingdom, the love of glory, or even the sense of shame, should have urged him to meet his rival in the field. In the Battle of Nineveh, his courage might have taught the Persians to vanquish, or he might have fallen with honor by the lance of a Roman emperor. The successor of Cyrus chose rather, at a secure distance, to expect the event, to assemble the relics of the defeat, and to retire by measured steps before the march of Heraclius, till he beheld with a sigh the once-loved mansions of Dastagerd. Both his friends and enemies were persuaded that it was the intention of Chosroes to bury himself under the ruins of the city and palace. And as both might have been equally adverse to his flight, the monarch of Asia, with Sira and three concubines, escaped through a hole in the wall 9 days before the arrival of the Romans. The slow and stately procession in which he showed himself to the prostrate crowd was changed to a rapid and secret journey. and the first evening he lodged in the cottage of a peasant, whose humble door would scarcely give admittance to the great king. His superstition was subdued by fear. On the third day he entered with joy the fortifications of Ctesiphon. Yet he still doubted of his safety till he had opposed the river Tigris to the pursuit of the Romans. The discovery of his flight agitated with terror and tumult the palace, the city, and the camp of Dostagerd. The satraps hesitated whether they had most to fear from their sovereign or the enemy, and the females of the harem were astonished and pleased by the sight of mankind, till the jealous husband of 3,000 wives again confined them to a more distant castle. At his command the army of Dostagerd retreated to a new camp. The front was covered by the Arber and a line of 200 elephants. The troops of the more distant provinces successively arrived, and the vilest domestics of the king and satraps were enrolled for the last defense of the throne. It was still in the power of Chosroes to obtain a reasonable peace, and he was repeatedly pressed by the messengers of Heraclius to spare the blood of his subjects, and to relieve a humane conqueror from the painful duty of carrying fire and sword through the fairest countries of Asia. But the pride of the Persian had not yet sunk to the level of his fortune. He derived a momentary confidence from the retreat of the emperor. He wept with impotent rage over the ruins of his Assyrian palaces, and disregarded too long the rising murmurs of the nation, who complained that their lives and fortunes were sacrificed to the obstinacy of an old man. That unhappy old man was himself tortured with the sharpest pains both of mind and body, and in the consciousness of his approaching end, he resolved to fix the tiara on the head of Merdaza, the most favored of his sons. But the will of Chosroes was no longer revered, and Siruiz, who gloried in the rank and merit of his mother Sirrah, had conspired with the malcontents to assert and anticipate the rights of primogeniture. 22 satraps, they styled themselves patriots, were tempted by the wealth and honors of a new reign. To the soldiers, the heirs of Chosroes promised an increase of pay. To the Christians, the free exercise of their religion. To the captives, liberty and rewards. And to the nation, instant peace and the reduction of taxes. It was determined by the conspirators that Siruiz, with the ensigns of royalty, should appear in the camp, and if the enterprise should fail, his escape was contrived to the imperial court. But the new monarch was saluted with unanimous acclamations. The flight of Chosroes, yet where could he have fled, was rudely arrested. 18 sons were massacred before his face, and he was thrown into a dungeon, where he expired on the fifth day. The Greeks and modern Persians minutely describe how Chosroes was insulted and famished and tortured by the command of an inhuman son, who so far surpassed the example of his father. But at the time of his death, what tongue would relate the story of the parricide? What eye could penetrate into the Tower of Darkness? According to the faith and mercy of his Christian enemies, he sunk without hope into a still deeper abyss. And it will not be denied that tyrants of every age and sect are the best entitled to such infernal abodes. The glory of the House of Sasan ended with the life of Chosroes. His unnatural son enjoyed only 8 months the fruit of his crimes, and in the space of 4 years, the regal title was assumed by 9 candidates who disputed with the sword or dagger the fragments of an exhausted monarchy. Every province and each city of Persia was the scene of independence, of discord, and of blood. And the state of anarchy prevailed about 8 years longer, till the factions were silenced and united under the common yoke of the Arabian caliphs. As soon as the mountains became passable, the emperor received the welcome news of the success of the conspiracy, the death of Chosroes, and the elevation of his eldest son to the throne of Persia. The authors of the revolution, eager to display their merits in the court or camp of Tauris, preceded the ambassadors of Siroes, who delivered the letters of their master to his brother, the emperor of the Romans. In the language of the usurpers of every age, he imputes his own crimes to the deity, and without degrading his equal majesty, he offers to reconcile the long discord of the two nations by a treaty of peace and alliance more durable than brass or iron. The conditions of the treaty were easily defined and faithfully executed. In the recovery of the standards and prisoners which had fallen into the hands of the Persians, the emperor imitated the example of Augustus. Their care of the national dignity was celebrated by the poets of the times, but the decay of genius may be measured by the distance between Horace and George of Pisidia. The subjects and brethren of Heraclius were redeemed from persecution, slavery, and exile, but instead of the Roman eagles, the true wood of the Holy Cross was restored to the importunate demands of the successor of Constantine. The victor was not ambitious of enlarging the weakness of the empire. The son of Chosroes abandoned, without regret, the conquests of his father. The Persians who evacuated the cities of Syria and Egypt were honorably conducted to the frontier, and a war which had wounded the vitals of the two monarchies produced no change in their external and relative situation. The return of Heraclius from Tauris to Constantinople was a perpetual triumph, and after the exploits of 6 glorious campaigns, he peaceably enjoyed the Sabbath of his toils. After a long impatience, the Senate, the clergy, and the people went forth to meet their hero with tears and acclamations, with olive branches and innumerable lamps. He entered the capital in a chariot drawn by 4 elephants, and as soon as the emperor could disengage himself from the tumult of public joy, he tasted more genuine satisfaction in the embraces of his mother and his son. The succeeding year was illustrated by triumph of a very different kind, the restitution of the true cross to the Holy Sepulchre. Heraclius performed in person the pilgrimage of Jerusalem. The identity of the relic was verified by the discreet patriarch, and this august ceremony has been commemorated by the annual festival of the Exaltation of the Cross. Before the emperor presumed to tread the consecrated ground, he was instructed to strip himself of the diadem and purple, the pomp and vanity of the world. But in the judgment of his clergy, the persecution of the Jews was more easily reconciled with the precepts of the gospel. He again ascended his throne to receive the congratulations of the ambassadors of France and India, and the fame of Moses, Alexander, and Hercules was eclipsed in the popular estimation by the superior merit and glory of the great Heraclius. Yet the deliverer of the East was indigent and feeble. Of the Persian spoils, the most valuable portion had been expended in the war, distributed to the soldiers, or buried by an unlucky tempest in the waves of the Black Sea. The conscience of the emperor was oppressed by the obligation of restoring the wealth of the clergy, which he had borrowed for their own defense. A perpetual fund was required to satisfy these inexorable creditors. The provinces, already wasted by the arms and avarice of the Persians, were compelled to a second payment of the same taxes. And the arrears of a simple citizen, the treasurer of Damascus, were commuted to a fine of 100,000 pieces of gold. The loss of 200,000 soldiers who had fallen by the